Welcome, everybody. I am Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I am joined by Anastasia Esther in the production booth. Welcome, Anya. How are you doing this afternoon?
I am good, Maggie. It doesn't feel like afternoon, though. It feels like the middle of the night here.
Doesn't it?
It's so dark.
Daylight savings. Whenever we do this, I end up thinking it's 10 p.m. and I need to go to bed. My internal clock is all screwed up.
Yep, absolutely.
It's a real thing for me. I don't mind the sun in the morning. That's helpful. But then we get so very, very little of it during these months. Hope you're all adjusting to the new clocks. I also hope you're all adjusting and enjoying these election outcomes from last night. I've got my Roe v. Wade t-shirt on. I don't know if you can see it there. If you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, thank you, Ohio. Not once, but twice. Now asserting and affirming a woman's free choice, healthcare liberty, which we all should be entitled to. We spent some time on this show back when Republicans in Ohio tried to change the threshold by which their constitution would be amended and up that requirement to 60%. Voters also rejected that a few months ago. That was, of course, just a proxy vote on abortion. They were doing that ahead of this vote yesterday that Ohioans took on whether to enshrine the right to healthcare freedom in the Ohio Constitution. And indeed, despite having a Republican governor and basically, you know, Jim Jordan's from Ohio too, everybody, lots of GOP folks representing the state of Ohio on this issue, just resoundingly Ohioans stepping up for healthcare freedom. What a good result. We saw a Democratic governor reelected in Kentucky. What was supposed to be maybe a nail biter came out on top. We also have the Marquette poll dropping. Lots of things happening this week, prognostication wise. And so much of what I'm hearing is both mixes of jubilation with many of the results from the election last night, but also some trepidation as Democrats begin hand-wringing over what might happen a year from today. Well, first and foremost, stop that. Polls are a point in time. What is most important is that we all continue to focus on those things that have the most direct and immediate impact on our collective quality of life. And healthcare freedom is certainly one of them. But there's a whole lot of other things that are going on. Like, do we have an actual minimum wage? Does the healthcare system work for the vast majority of people? Does our tax system appropriately tax the richest of us and corporations the most? Do we have meaningful childcare? You know, the stuff that matters. And I want to take a collective breath and get ourselves focused on that, because I think if we continue to talk about those things, healthcare freedom, minimum and actual living wage for folks that are willing to put in a good hard 40 hours worth of work, meaningful healthcare, childcare, and all those good things, that will lead us to a certain place. And the other thing that I'd like to just immediately take up, and Anya, thanks so much for getting some of the sound together, is this completely absurd concept that Biden's some old guy who doesn't have it together, when the clear favorite for the Republican nomination indisputably does not have the marbles all functioning together. I mean, the things that Donald Trump has said just this week are not just cringy, they're crazy. I mean, he liked to pontificate about his mental acuity before. I wouldn't be going there now. If we can, Anya, let's take a listen to what Trump had to say about the 2020 election just this past November 4th, just this past week. This is cut number two.
We won in the last time 50 states. Think of it, 50 states. We won every state. We then did great in the election. We got 12 million more votes or so, 12 million more votes than we got the first time.
What? know how any of this stuff works? Apparently not. We won all 50 states. Huh? That's concerning. And then the odd turn of phrase, and then we went on to win the election. They're not separate things, sir.
It's interesting he thinks you could win all 50 states and not win the election, in fact.
Right, which implies... confusing. Yeah, the whole thing is just cringy. I also like this one, fairly recent. This is cut number one. Wait a minute, who was he campaigning against in 2020? Let's ask him. Donald Trump, this is cut one.
With Obama, we won an election that everyone said couldn't be won. We have a man who is totally corrupt and the worst president in the history of our country, who is cognitively impaired.
I just want to say I didn't add this music.
Now in charge of dealing with Russia. Just think of it. We would be in World War II. In World War II. In World War II. Very quickly. You know, the beauty was when I came here, everyone thought Bush was going to win. And then they took a poll and they found out Trump was up by about 50 points. Everyone said, what's going on right here? They thought Bush, because Bush supposedly was a military person. Great. You know what? He was a military. He got us into the Middle East. How did that work out? Right. But they all thought that Bush might win. Jeb. Remember Jeb?
That's that one.
Oi! Dear sir, World War II already happened. Dear sir, you ran against Hillary Clinton in 2016. Like, what? And it's interesting to me because not only do I think it shows cognitive decline, I think it shows conscious disregard. In other words, none of the actual facts have ever mattered to this guy. So if it never matters to you and you just make it up as you go along and everybody's like, yeah, that's great. You know, why does it matter if you weren't actually running against Obama? You can just say that. Anyway, this other one, many of you probably haven't heard this one. This is cut three. Listen to what he says about the Revolutionary War.
Waters of the Delaware. And seized victory from Cornwallis of Yorktown. Our army manned the airport. It ran the ramparts. It took over the airports. It did everything it had to do. And at Fort McHenry, under the rocket's red glare, it had nothing but victory.
You know when Washington crossed the Delaware airport to make his flight on time?
Yeah, to board the plane to go fly to the other battle to fight them. Partly because he's reading a teleprompter, he doesn't even have consciousness about the words that are coming out of his mouth because he's just reading copy. I mean, dear person who puts Trump's copy on teleprompters, please one day insert some really, 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 really ridiculous stuff. Because, wow, he'll just say it. So, I mean, there's, again, the polls are the polls. Let's not all get freaked out. And please, can we stop with the nonsense about Joe Biden's age? Yes, it's a concern, but it's not a concern that's unique to Joe Biden. And if I'm going to put the two side by side and ask objectively, who understands the way that government functions, our government functions, who understands U.S. history, who understands how a bill becomes law, who knows what year it is, who they're running against. If there were airports during the Revolutionary War, I'll tell you who I think that is. It's Joe Biden. And if you don't want to take my word for it, just Google Fox News hosts concerned over Trump's cognitive acumen, because that's where we got half of these sound bites from, because they're observing it too. And here's what. It's biological, physiological, psychological truth that when you are under extraordinary levels of stress, all sorts of hormones flood your brain and your nervous system And you actually start reverting back to basically like your reptilian brain. In other words, you're not as rational, if that's even a word that at some point in time could be applied to our former president, as you would otherwise be. And when you're not as rational as you would otherwise be, you actually start saying what's really on your mind. So it matters a lot that Donald Trump is verbally decompensating before our eyes. Being the president is very stressful. And I don't think any of this is an indicator that toe-to-toe, Trump has a cognitive advantage over Joe Biden. I mean, that's just not objectively observable. And if we care about whether or not our president is firing on all cognitive cylinders, which I think is a value we can all say matters, and probably matters more right now in this year than it did in 2015 at this very same time of year, because of the threats and the destabilization in the world order, then that leads us to a certain conclusion and place. I would also be remiss if I didn't mention this, and Todd Albo has done a really incredible job of talking about this on his show. So if you haven't heard Todd discuss Joe Biden's speech impediment, go ahead and check it out, because a lot of times when people are like, oh, he's pausing for a long time, he's lost his train of thought, that is simply incorrect. That is Joe Biden using his conscious present brain to be sure that he doesn't stutter. And that makes all the difference. Listen, if you want to join the conversation, 844-967-2789. Do you have reactions to the polls? Because there's a lot of them out there. Also, you are going to want to keep it locked. We're going to be joined by Mary Ellen O'Collin, professor of the international law of war, at the bottom of the hour. She's going to help us understand what is happening between Israel and Hamas right now. Keep it. Welcome back, everybody. I am Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Cranberries, one of their most epic tracks, Zombie. Yeah, that's some war music right there, isn't it? Welcome back. We are talking about some of the polling. We're going to be joined at the bottom of the hour by Notre Dame professor of law, Mary Ellen O'Connell, who recently, just yesterday, had an op-ed published by CNN asking President Biden to publicly call for a ceasefire in Gaza. She's going to help us understand the law of war and the rules that war should be conducted according to. And that may seem like a lofty ideal or goal, but many of these norms and laws have been around for a very, very long time. And I think it's worthy of observation. There are rules. There are laws. What are they? And how do they apply to what's going on? You're not going to want to miss that. Really, really privileged to have Professor O'Connell joining. And don't turn the dial after Professor O'Connell's done. We are going to be joined by Civic Media's own Terry Barr to talk about what's local and overlooked in Wisconsin news before the Maggie Dawn Show is out. Also, next week, I'm out of pocket until Thursday, when I'm going to be joined by the University of Wisconsin-Madison's men's a cappella group, the Mad Hatters. This is going to get you in the holiday spirit. Don't miss that either. So one of the most interesting little bits of polling information came from the Marquette poll today. And I was frankly just shocked by this. They asked about voters' impressions, you know, favorable, unfavorable, neutral, or don't know, about a number of elected officials in Wisconsin, including Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. And I was floored by the results. Assembly Speaker Voss has a 16% favorable rating. Wow. 36% unfavorable and 46% undecided. That one just blows me away. You know, one of the things that I frequently talk about on the show is the fact that most politics is actually local. But what happens is that the local politics gets sucked up into the dialogue or the framework that is occurring on the national stage, which right now is hyper partisan. But in reality, much of what we do at the state and local government level isn't partisan. It's road building, it's funding schools, it's parks, it's basic social services, it's picking up your garbage, these kinds of things. And while I think anyone who's center or left of center can criticize some of the proposals from Robin Voss, what I would also say is this: if you're reading between the lines for Speaker Voss, I would argue that it has been clear for years that Speaker Voss is incredibly uncomfortable with the MAGA movement. He's incredibly uncomfortable with election denialism. I don't think he wanted to hire Michael Gableman to do this bogus investigation, which turned up nothing and cost over $1 million. I don't think he wanted to do any of that. So, you know, whether or not that this particular poll, this moment in time, sticks to Speaker Voss, and again, this is statewide, this isn't Voss's district, which would, of course, be different. But I just found this shocking. 16% favorable, which means Dems hate him and many Republicans do too, or they at least are neutral, which is shocking. I think to me, it shows how the national partisanship is eclipsing and blinding us to how we need to evaluate and judge our closer to home elected officials, including Speaker Voss. Let it be done not on how he reacts to Donald Trump, but how he leads the Republican majority in the assembly. Do the bills being introduced by that Republican majority reflect the values of the majority of Wisconsinites? Are they showing a reinvestment or an increased investment in childcare? Are they providing tax breaks that benefit mostly the wealthy at the expense of the middle class? And I will criticize them on that basis, certainly. But the idea that he's only getting 16% favorable, I can only attribute to the fact that conservatives and Republicans in this state don't like him because he's not right enough. And that, my friends, scares me a bit. That part's scary. Again, I disagree with much of what Robin Voss proposes, but a rating that low is pointing to a much broader problem. So again, as we go into this election cycle, let's try to collectively ground our discussion, our analysis, and our critiques, our praise in what are these elected officials and candidates proposing in terms of real policy? Because that is what actually matters. I think it's why when you look at somebody like Vivek Ramaswamy, and the Republican debate's going to go on again tonight, third one, no Donald Trump, we're going to listen to four candidates, no Mike Pence, talk about things. And unfortunately, debate stages aren't great policy wonk environments. They don't require candidates to explain and engage not just what their values are or what their talking points are, but truly what their legislative proposals would be. What are the things that are most important to you if you were to become president? And Vivek, again, is one of the most lightweight candidates out there. Much of what he says that even approaches a policy is just nonsense and shows a very low understanding or low regard for the way government works. But I will also challenge you this. Listen carefully to what candidate Nikki Haley is actually saying, because you cannot be all things to all people. Ask yourself, what priorities is Secretary of State Haley, Ambassador to the UN Haley, what is she actually articulating? And does that help you understand what kind of a president she might be? Because my critique of former Ambassador Haley is just that. She is trying to be all things to all people. And I question whether or not the policies and legislation that she would pursue as president would truly reflect middle-class working folk values. Because that has not been the brand of the Republican Party for quite some time. You're going to want to keep it locked. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Professor Mary Ellen O'Connell from Notre Dame's Law School to talk about whether or not President Biden should be calling for a ceasefire amongst Israel and Hamas. Keep it locked. It's the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Waited out on the streets of a runaway American dream. At night we ran through mansions of glory and suicide machines. Sprung from cages on Highway 9, chrome wheel fuel injection and stepping out over the line. Whoa, baby, this town lifts the bones from your back. It's a death trap. It's a suicide trap. We gotta get out while we're young. Cause tramps like us, baby, we were born to run.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Really happy to be joined by Professor of International Law and the Law of War, Mary Ellen O'Connell, joining us on the phones. Professor of Law at the University of Notre Dame, she just published an op-ed in CNN titled, Biden Needs to Call for a Ceasefire and Restore Respect for International Law. She is also the co-author of a book published in 2019 titled, Self-Defense Against Non-State Actors. I can't imagine anyone better to talk to at this critical moment for peace and security at such a critical point of conflict between Israel and Hamas. Welcome, Professor O'Connell. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Maggie, for inviting me. It's really important to get this information, this kind of conversation out into the world. So thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. We've been trying to engage this conversation with our listeners, with a broader audience, because these are sensitive topics. And bringing experts like yourself and the knowledge that you have about the international law of armed conflict, aka the law of war, to bear is so critical. Can you just set the foundation a bit for our listeners? What is the international law of war and what are the sources for that law?
Okay, thanks, Maggie. It's something that was better known, very widely known in this country during and after the Second World War, and then over time, for a variety of reasons that if your listeners are interested, we could go into, but to the current point, we've just lost a lot of this knowledge. So we have two really important different sets of rules and principles that govern what's going on right now in Ukraine versus Russia, in Israel versus Hamas, and in other armed conflicts around the world. We start with the United Nations Charter, and it has codified an ancient principle prohibiting in the first instance, any resort to military force. So even before we get into any fighting, if a country is interested in using military force to promote some policy, that is forbidden and has been since ancient times, but in very strict and straightforward language in the United Nations Charter, binding on Israel, binding on the United States.
Specifically, this is Article 2, Sub 4, and it prohibits the use of force outside of the boundaries of your nation state, unless you are engaging in self-defense. I'll hand the mic back over to you, Professor. Please continue.
Okay, so, it's a comprehensive prohibition. The actual text of the prohibition was written by the United States when we were the chief drafters of the UN Charter during and after the Second World War. It's comprehensive. There are only two express limitations in the UN Charter. One is when the Security Council acts to authorize the use of force, rarely used, and then the second one is the more commonly cited Article 51 for self-defense, and that's the one that Israel is invoking right now. We can talk about, and I'd like to make a few comments about where Israel falls short then, but let's just briefly talk about the law that is more commonly in the news that people are thinking about, even though, honestly, as I think is obvious to your listeners, those UN Charter rules are the first rules, and we really need to know and understand those. They have implications for the United States and whether we have even a legal right to assist Israel in this war that it's conducting. Any war, regardless of whether it's being waged lawfully, and all wars are only potentially waged lawfully by one side, the lawful defender. In Russia, Ukraine, it's easy. Russia is the aggressor. It violated 2-4. Ukraine is the defender. Article 51, it can push the Russian forces out of its territory. That's its legal right, and some would say even its duty. Regardless of whether one or both parties are fighting lawfully in an armed conflict, all parties to an armed conflict have to obey the Geneva Conventions in how they're conducting the war. And there are four really important principles never to be forgotten that are in those treaties and related law. First, you never intentionally target civilians. Second, any use of military force, even when you're not intentionally targeting civilians, has to be necessary. It's got to create a gain for the state using force, a definite military advantage. Even then, civilian life and civilian property cannot be disproportionately killed and destroyed. And finally, regardless of those three principles, every party to a conflict must never forget their humanity, their own humanity and the humanity of the people who are being victimized in armed conflict. So we've got problems across the board in the Israel-Hamas war.
I want to summarize and reemphasize these four principles. Once two entities, sometimes state actors, sometimes non-state actors, are engaged in armed conflict, the Geneva Convention applies. It requires, to emphasize and repeat what Professor O'Connell has said, one, what they call civilian distinction. You cannot engage in indiscriminate targeting directly of civilians or engage in warfare or battle tactics that indiscriminately harm civilians. Secondly, there has to be a military necessity that will provide a definite, a specified, understandable, and articulable military advantage. Thirdly, you cannot target in a way that disproportionately causes civilian lives. And fourth, what you term in your op-ed as the principle of humanity. In other words, even engaged in war, you must do so in a way that seeks to limit suffering, injury, and destruction to non-combatants and civilian. So critical. I can hear folks listening saying, but what about when you're dealing with terrorist groups like Hamas? Help us understand, Professor.
We always expect those who are using lethal force consistently with international law to separate themselves from criminals and from violators of the law. We have really important rules on how to fight lawfully that are from ancient times that reflect international humanity's basic notions of morality. You can say, I'm fighting against a lawless force that doesn't respect these rules, but does that allow you at any time in any legal context to say, well, okay, then I don't have to respect the rules either because these criminals are not respecting the rules? It doesn't make sense. And yet we hear this argument time and again. The international law, all law is absolutely clear. Those who seek to follow the rule of law must obey the principles regardless of what their opponents, their adversaries, what the criminals they're dealing with are doing.
It's such a difficult concept, I think, for many of us to understand, one, and two, embrace and adopt. And I think our human limitations in that call to a really higher sense of justice reflects some of the difficulty that world leaders have. That this isn't just us mere mortals struggling with these things. Professors of law can articulate them as you so well have, but it is very difficult in practice. I wanted to emphasize something else that your op-ed made plain relating to this principle of humanity, and that these longstanding concepts, not only in the UN Charter, not only in the Geneva Conventions, but based in ancient norms and laws and principles, that precludes the assumption that if something isn't specifically prohibited in international law, that it is permissible. In fact, the opposite is true, and that there are these sometimes, to again us mere mortals, seemingly technocratic or legalistic requirements, for example, the UN Security Council permitting a nation to engage in armed conflict, or an invitation by one sovereign nation to another to enter into their borders to try to eradicate an adversarial force. I'm referencing what you discussed in your op-ed, where following the U.S.'s engagement with ISIS, Iraq actually issued a formal invitation to the United States to come into its territory and provide military assistance against ISIS. Can you explain why that formality is so very important?
Maybe it helps. Well, I just want to make two points. First is a very general one. I've been teaching international law on the use of force for almost 40 years. And I've really seen a general decline in knowledge, especially since the end of the Cold War, when the United States, for example, has become much more aggressive in using military force. We didn't think we had to debate in international fora against the Soviet Union to justify what we were doing, that the world was looking at two countries that were constantly challenging each other to show why what we were doing was consistent with the law. Now, once the Cold War was over, it seems like advisors to our presidents in both parties were just giving them an open door, because who was going to challenge us? And now, of course, we're being challenged all over, including by a disintegrating respect for international law. And we've helped build this current moment of crisis through failing to respect the rules that we were committed to since the founding of this country.
So if we really can, Professor, let me just jump in there. In a way, if I can put in lay terms, what we have seen, as you're describing, is almost a race to the bottom. The reason that those of us nation states like the United States who say we believe in the rule of law, we believe in international law, why it is so critical for us to call upon our allies and to also require that we succeed to those higher principles, is because if we don't, it leads to increasing and accelerating destabilization and the engagement by all actors in violation of these very principles. Is that a perhaps a more lay way of saying that we're seeing some of the results of this degradation of norms, which is leading a bit to this race to the bottom?
I absolutely think that's right. But I might use a different metaphor than race to the bottom.
Please.
Because we're not, I think what happened is a case of hubris. The United States didn't think anyone was going to challenge us after the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And so we didn't think that we thought we were above the law. I think we see a lot, I see in tracking U.S. uses of force in 1991, a great deal of hubris, of the sense that no one's going to challenge us, so therefore we can do what we want. We're too big to fail. That's the metaphor I think of. And of course, the worst reason to obey the law is because you think you're going to get something out of it, as opposed to because you revere the law. So
yes, Professor, we're running out of time. I'm so sorry to interrupt. If you are willing, I know everyone listening would appreciate the opportunity to hear you talk on this some more. I will reach out to you if you're willing. We will have you back on.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor O'Connell. We appreciate
Maggie, you're a great conversation partner. We'll do it again.
Wonderful. Everybody keep it locked. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. No topic too complex for us to take on.
What are you always standing for?
Doesn't like System of a Down, especially a cover by a woman of System of a Down. Most excellent. Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We're on our last segment for the day, and I'm so excited to be joined by one of Civic Media's most veteran news reporters, Terry Barr. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Maggie. It's great to be here. Thanks for asking me to join you.
Of course, we're really excited. We're going to be doing this segment on the regular here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Typically, you can hear it at 6:30 on Thursdays. We'll be back in the first week of December. But we thought we'd give everybody a taste because, Terry, you keep track of what is local and overlooked that's going on in the state of Wisconsin. What do you have for our listeners this week?
Okay, I've got two headlines for you that are not even in the headlines right now, Maggie. This is concerning growing reports of farm equipment being stolen. This is happening all across the state right now. And as you probably are aware, farm equipment is not cheap. We're talking $50,000 at the low price for some of the things that are being stolen. Now, what police are saying, some of these things, they're not finding them anywhere. They may be taking them out of state, but some are also ending up at auction houses. So the crooks taking these items are then turning around, selling them at an auction and getting some money back for it. So again, if you talk about a tractor, $50,000, there's also examples of silo unloaders and grain drills being stolen. And all a person would have to do, and I'm not making a secret here, but you could just back up, put it on your truck, and off you go. So police are also trying to remind people working in any of these farming situations, lock your doors on your tractors and on some of these other equipment pieces that are being stolen. Take the batteries out or unhook so a crook can't just back up.
As if farming
wasn't, that's the first one.
Yeah, as if farming wasn't hard enough to make a living at and required so much blood, sweat, and tears in a literal sense. Now folks
are taking
the very tools and equipment they need to do this work that is such a backbone of the Wisconsin economy. What a shame. Any indications about what the obligations of these auction houses are to verify whether or not there's actually like a deed of ownership?
Correct. And in many cases now, they're putting things online and asking farmers to try to help these auction houses identify if that equipment could be theirs. You know, and then they want them to bring in the, you know, show us that you own this. Did you engrave maybe on the piece of equipment your name or number that we can match it to you that you own it? So they are working together with police and farmers to try to stop this.
Wonderful. Well, you heard it from Terry. Lock it up, lock the doors, engrave it, mark it, sticker it, do something so everybody knows it's yours.
Yeah.
What else do you got for us
yes.
this Wednesday?
I have one more quick one for you. Yeah. Well, you know, Veterans Day is Saturday. So did you know there is a Wisconsin-based organization helping military members actually get a ticket to come home and visit their families? I know that sounds like that should be easy, but it's often not. So here's Larry Jackson. He's the president of the Ben Jackson Foundation. And I'm just going to let him explain.
Our mission is really about reuniting military families. And we do that by helping young people in the military travel home to see their family, to see their friends and loved ones when they're stationed somewhere across the country or across the globe. A lot of times they're 18, 19, 20, just getting started. They can get some time off from work for the military, or they can get the leave. But many times they just can't afford to get that $2,000 ticket home from Okinawa or Japan or Germany and see their family. So that's what we're about. Helping reunite military families. And we do that by making sure money's not a reason why people can't come back.
Now, Larry is based in Mount Horeb. He started this when his son couldn't get home for a visit. Luckily, he did make it home. He was able to get him a ticket. But then sadly, what happened and what made Larry realize he needed to do something like this, his son was then killed when he went back to the military base where he was now being set up in Japan. So Larry now has started this foundation where he tries to help bring military members who simply cannot afford this to get them home to see their family. So important and perfect timing to talk about something like this with Veterans Day on Saturday. If you want to learn more, if you need support for your family, or you want to give some support, go to benjacksonfoundation.org.
How wonderful, Terry. Thank you so much. Both news and a public service announcement. Again, that is benjackson.org. If you want to help active military get home to see their families, a worthy cause for us all, please have a give my thanks, Terry, to Larry for doing this incredible work. I've got a number of family and friends that have given big chunks of their lives to the military. I'll also note that Veterans Day happens to be also the birthday of the United States Marine Corps. My former Marine friend, Christine Westrich, told me that today. So hats off to you, Christine. Thank you for your service. And thank you, Terry. I'm so looking forward to this segment every week because I know that there's a whole lot of stuff that I don't get to see. This is going to be great. Well, thanks so much.
I will be happy to bring it to you and share it.
Yay! And all of our listeners. So we'll see you and talk to you again, Terry, that first week of December. Everybody listening on the Civic Media Radio Network, you can hear from Terry starting in December every Thursday afternoon at 6:30 on the Maggie Dawn Show. If you're wondering what to pay attention to this afternoon, if you don't want to watch that debate, don't worry. You can listen to the Milwaukee Bucks here on the Civic Media Radio Network. The WCRE out of Richland Center, Air Support, WISS in Oshkosh, the Tap in Eau Claire, WLAK Lake Air in Amory, WRJN 99.9 FM in Racine, and of course, Park Falls 98.3 FM, WCQM. It has been real. Thank you, Terry. Thank you, Anya. Thank you to all the listeners out there. Happy Veterans Day, everybody, and keep it safe.
Our awesome
good stuff, ladies.
And the Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.